You noticed. Why is Amos famous?
Not cookies.
Not because of the chocolate chip cookies, okay? Just so you realize that. I wanted to get that out of the way. Wanted to get that out of the way so we could carry on. It's funny. I had a book in my basement that I must have taught one of the minor prophets years ago. But the Lord knew that I would need it in 2025 here. And the guy that wrote it, who made synopsis in there, he was a cartoonist also. You know what? Candy corn. You know how it's kind of triangle like this? Well, there's a cartoon. And the guy has got his arms crossed, and he's looking kind of like this. And he's got this smirk on his face, this very sarcastic smirk. And it says, the printer could leave the minor prophets out of the Bible, and most people wouldn't even know the difference. And that kind of it's kind of the truth, really. I was saying something to one of my acquaintances about studying Amos, and she said, I never even heard of him. And I don't think that that's all that unusual. And somebody else says, I'm going to have to go to the index to find that one. And there's truth to that, too. Some of you did. And as a matter of fact, I would go, let's see, Jonah, Micah, Nahum. Wait a minute. Hosea, Joel, Amos. There he is. Okay, so I got him. Now, I want you to understand something. They're not called minor prophets because they're younger than 18, first of all. Just get that out of the way. And they're not called minor prophets because there are 12 of them. They're not called minor prophets because they're unimportant. It's the size and the volume and the number of their chapters. Isaiah is 66 chapters long. Ezekiel is 48. Jeremiah is 52. And Daniel is 12. Wait a minute. You say Hosea, or not Hosea, Amos that we're talking about today, tonight, it's only 9, 12 and 9 is a month. If you go to the book of Daniel, every single chapter, it starts and boom, it goes way over there. It's actually 53% larger than Amos is. In the book of Amos, we've got a chapter like this very first chapter. It's 15 verses. Then there's something that's maybe 12 verses. There is one chapter that's 26, I think, or 27. But you see what I'm getting at. They're not long. They're very condensed. They're very short. And so just as long as you realize that this idea of them being minor is not because they're unimportant, because they don't have as much in them. What they have in them is heavy, heavy, lots of stuff. Let's look at this. Verses 1 and 2. The words of Amos, who was among the shepherds of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. This is what I've entitled it the information verse. 42 words. But man, what is packed in this? Look at this right at the beginning. The words of Amos. Now what's going to follow is what Amos was told to say. Prophets get their messages from God. These are going to be the words of Amos, what he tells them, but they're going to be what God has told him to tell them. Then we come to this name, Amos. Oh my goodness. I'm probably going to spend longer time than I should on this, but Amos's name means, it's derived from a Hebrew word that means to be burdened or to carry. It's associated with a sense of duty. a sense of calling, a sense of moral responsibility. In some African cultures, the name represents strength and leadership. In European language, it's associated with steadfastness and reliability. And whatever you say about Amos, he is burdened to do but what he has been entrusted to do. He is going to live out his name. Then we see this, who was among the shepherds of Tekoa. He was among the shepherds. Now I got to tell you something. Shepherds were either at or near the bottom of the social order. And do you know why? Because in the beautiful, nice weather, they were always with their sheep. In the blistering heat and the sun that could just scald them to pieces, they were with their sheep. In the rain, they were with the sheep. In the snow, they were with the sheep. If one of the sheep dropped a lamb while they were moving from one place to another, while he was taking them to the good pastures and to the still waters, whatever, he would pick that little sheep up and carry it, afterbirth and all. They were, this is a little bit of deology here. Maybe I'm taking a little bit more than I should, but I would think that there's a very real possibility that before you ever saw the shepherd, you might smell him. He was with them all the time. What an irony here. I see some irony here. He is God's choice. He's God's choice to prophesy against Israel's wealthy apostate leaders, those who were supposed to be the shepherds. Now, my ESV, where it says he was of the shepherds of Tekoa, it's got a little footnote that says sheep breeders, and I don't think that's right. A sheep breeder was someone that was in charge of a bunch of shepherds, and they did their work for him, but they, the sheep breeders, made the profit because the other ones were working for him. You get that? I think that's totally wrong because, and I'm not trying to steal somebody's, you can look at this later, you can write it down and look at it later, but in chapter 7, verse 14 and 15, it tells us that he tells someone that he was a herdsman and a dresser of sycamore figs. Now, you know what a sycamore, or what a fig is. Figs grow on trees, up high. They grow on trees. A sycamore fig, it is small, almost berry-like, and it grows on a bush that is very close to the ground. And these sycamore figs are eaten only by the poor. Only by the poor. They might give them to their sheep also. But I'm wanting you to get such an idea of this idea of him being a shepherd. What? I mean, this is just unbelievable. And even when you come to the New Testament and Jesus talks about how he's with his sheep, I'm the good shepherd. Listen, he's with you in the sunshine. He's with you trying to take you to the good pastures. He's with you when it's raining, when you're down and out. And if there's any wolves, any coyotes, any bears, anything that comes that's a threat to you, he's right there with you. It's still a beautiful picture, even into the New Testament. And when you think about what a shepherd is, looking at Psalm 23, it's for his namesake. He does this for his glory. He does this for himself. And like I said, I don't want to beat this to death, but I want you to realize this is pretty ironic that we have a shepherd here that is going to take God's message. And next we see, it says, the words of Amos, who was among the shepherds of Tekoa. That tells you where he comes from. If you take out your little map, look at this. See where Tekoa is. Tekoa is a very small village southeast of Bethlehem. And it's about 5 miles southeast of Bethlehem. And it's about 10 to 11 miles from Jerusalem and about 18 miles from the Dead Sea. And you know what the word Tekoa means? It literally means trumpet. To declare, to make known, to announce. We've got this shepherd who, like I said, is not the most influential of people, coming from a place that is called to trumpet, to announce. And I think all of this just goes round and round and round here. I think that's just a beautiful thing to see. And what we've done is we've only read 11 words, and yet we have found out an immense amount about Amos. And then it says, the words of Amos, who was among the shepherds of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel, which he saw concerning Israel. Let that sink in. Where is he from? He's from Judah. Where is he taking his message to? Israel. That would be like if a Republican went to a Democratic convention and got up and said, you guys are being wrong and God's going to punish you for that. Or it would be like a Republican going to a Democratic convention and saying, you guys are doing it wrong and God's going to get you for that. And he's going to do it this way. We're going to find out how he's going to do it in a minute. But that, you know, you just need to let that sink in a little bit to really understand how heavy this message that he's taking, that's going to be in poetry, it, you know, which is usually a love language. We're not going to see love here, not in this point anyway. And it tells you it was in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. Now, there's a lot that needs to be said here. I need to have you go with me to 2 Chronicles 26, 2 Chronicles 26, and we're going to look at verses 5, whoops, wrong place, 5 through, let's see, we're going to look at 5 through 15.
What chapter was it?
2 Chronicles, chapter 26, and verses 5 through 15. And his father's name was Amaziah. Uzziah's father's name was Amaziah. And here, at times, he is called Azariah. They do that. I don't know why, but they do that. That's just life back in the Old Testament. There was other names here. But we see in 2 Chronicles and verses 5 through 15, right at the end of verse 15, it says, as long as he sought the Lord, God made him prosper. He went out and made war against the Philistines and broke through the wall of Gath and the wall of Jabneh and the wall of Ashdod, and he built cities in the territory of Ashdod and elsewhere among the Philistines. God helped him against the Philistines and against the Arabians who lived in Gerbaal and against the Munites. The Ammonites paid tribute to Uzziah. Now, he's using his name Uzziah. And his fame spread even to the border of Egypt, for he became very strong. Moreover, Uzziah built towers in Jerusalem at the corner gate and at the valley gate and at the angle and fortified them. And he built towers in the wilderness and cut out many cisterns, for he had large herds both in the Shephelah and in the plain. He had farmers and vine dressers in the hills and in the fertile lands, for he loved the soil. Moreover, Uzziah had an army of soldiers fit for war and divisions according to the numbers in the muster made Jael the secretary and Maaseiah the officer under the direction of Hananiah, one of the king's commanders. The whole number of the heads of the father's houses of mighty men of valor was 2,600. Under his command was an army of 300,500 who could make war with mighty power to help the king against the enemy. And Uzziah prepared for all the army shields, spear helmets, coats of mail, bows for slinging, for stones for singing. In Jerusalem, he made engines invented by skillful men to be on the towers and the corners to shoot arrows and great stone. And his fame spread far, for he was marvelously helped till he was strong. But when he was strong, he grew proud to his destruction, for he was unfaithful to the Lord his God. And listen at this, he entered the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. But Azariah, the priest, went in after him with 80 priests of the Lord who were men of valor. They withstood King Uzziah and said to him, "It's not for you, Uzziah, to burn incense to the Lord, but for the priests, the sons of Aaron, who are consecrated to burn incense. Go out of the sanctuary, for you have done wrong, and it will bring you no honor from the Lord God." Then Uzziah was angry. Now he had a censer in his hand to burn incense. And when he became angry with the priests, leprosy broke out on his forehead in the presence of the priests in the house of the Lord by the altar of incense. And Azariah, the chief priest, and all the priests looked at him, and behold, he was leprous in his forehead. And they rushed him out quickly, and he hurried himself to go out because the Lord had struck him. Then King Uzziah was a leper to the day of his death, and being a leper, lived in a separate house, for he was excluded from the house of the Lord. And Jotham, his son, was over the king's household, governing the people of the land. And it tells us that the rest of the acts of Uzziah, from first to last, Isaiah, the prophet of the son of Amoz, wrote. And Uzziah slept with his fathers, and they buried him with his fathers. So we see what happened to him. As long as he sought the Lord, the Lord made him prosper. But then when he was strong, he grew proud to his destruction. And then we come to another very wicked king, Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. Let's look in 2 Kings chapter 14, 2 Kings 14. And we're going to look at 2 Kings 14, verse 23. 2 Kings 14, verse 23. And we're going to go to chapter 15, verse 7. In the 15th year of Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah. Remember, I told you he's called Amaziah sometimes. Uzziah is called Amaziah sometimes. Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, began to reign in Samaria, and he reigned 41 years, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He didn't depart from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which made Israel to sin. He restored the border of Israel from Lebo Hamath, as far as the Sea of Araba, according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spoke by his servant, Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet, who was from Gath Hepher. For the Lord saw that the affliction of Israel was very bitter, for there was none left, bond or free. There was none to help Israel. But the Lord had not said that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven. So he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. Now the rest of the acts of Jeroboam and all that he did in his might, how he fought, how he restored Damascus and Hamath to Judah in Israel, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? And Jeroboam slept with his fathers, the kings of Israel, and Zechariah his son reigned in his place. And again we see in the 27th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Azariah, the son of Amaziah, the king of Judah, this is talking about Uzziah again, began to reign. He was 16 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 52 years in Jerusalem. Jump down, it says, he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. Nevertheless, the high places were not taken away. The papal sacrifice made offerings on the high place. And the Lord touched the king so that he was a leper to the day of his death. That's why we're talking about Uzziah. And it tells us in the... Okay, I think that's where I want to go with that. 2 Kings 14:27 talks about the Lord had not said that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, so he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. Now, from a very geopolitical perspective, Jeroboam took back all the territory that Israel had lost to the other nations, restoring the northern kingdom's borders. And he helped Judah regain sovereignty over regions that it had surrendered. Consequently, this was a great time of prosperity for Israel as God granted Israel success. We saw that in verse 27, but the Lord had not said that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, so he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. This was, geopolitically, this was a wonderful time for him. Yet this elite son forgot this. And the wealthy began to take advantage of the poor, and we're going to see that in Amos chapters 2 and chapters 5. And leaders boasted in their own strength, not in the Lord. You know, success is not inherently bad, but we should recognize something. We're more often tempted to trust in ourselves during the good times. And I don't think there's anybody here that doesn't realize that. But the end result was self-reliance and exploitation of others. Basically, that's what had happened. So, one other thing here we're going to read. Let's go back to... All right. The words of Amos, who was among the shepherds of Tekoa, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of King Uzziah, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, 2 years before the earthquake. This is a very, very distinct time marker, and it gives an unmistakable historicity or historical significance of the book and its message. Zechariah chapter 14 and 5, we won't turn there, but it talks about the great earthquake that happened in the time when Uzziah was made into a leper. But I want you to realize also, Josephus writes about it happening at this time when Uzziah becomes a leper. And what I have done, I did, what I put in the little box, This is something you really need to see. Google, what is the earthquake mentioned in Amos 1? And you're going to see a lot of stuff that will line up with what we've been talking about. But I want you to go to the Armstrong Institute of Biblical Archaeology, because that gives something that tells you exactly what was going on, what had happened about this earthquake, how they were tilted, collapsed walls, twisted, sunken floors, masonry and stones were completely split apart. That is something that, you know, I'm not going to get a whole lot in. Oh, well, I'm not going to get into it at all. But you need to go to that. You need to read that. It's a homework assignment because you'll it'll just kind of drop your mouth. Because this was written in 2022. And they're still talking about it. They're still finding evidence. They know about it. It's not something that I pulled out of a hat, in other words. So we've got some very distinctive things here. Very, very distinctive things. Now we come to verse 2. And he said, this is what Amos said, the Lord roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem. The pastures of the shepherds mourn, and the top of Carmel withers. Wow. The Lord roars. Right here we have a foundation that's being laid for the rest of the book. The Lord roars. And I want you to notice that. That's a capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. All capitals. And it underscores the personal and relational nature of God. This is God Jehovah. This is Jehovah Yahweh, the self-existent eternal one. And this is the Jewish national name of God, the one who reveals himself personally as the one who rules and acts in redemptive history. This is the Lord roars. This is a dramatically powerful verb. Now, who roars? Lions roar. And we first see something about lions in Genesis chapter 49, verses 9 through 10. Genesis 49, verses 9 through 10. We have Jacob blessing his sons. And in verses... No, he doesn't even talk about the firstborn or the secondborn or the thirdborn. He goes to Judah. And in verses 9 through 10, he says, Judah is a lion's cub from the prey. My son, you have gone up. He stooped down. He crouched as a lion. And as a lioness, who dares arouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until tribute comes to him, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. We first hear about a lion's cub, thinking about the lion's club. The lion's cub. This is what Judah says about him. Or Judah. This is what
Jacob
says about Judah. And he mentions the scepter is not going to depart from him. He's going to be king-like all the way through. He confirms leadership over all of his brothers here. Now, lions represent strength and authority in biblical narratives. As a matter of fact, in the ancient Near Eastern cultures, lions were used to represent powerful rulers. And these rulers stylized themselves as lions on seals and on palace reliefs. And we see them in Mesopotamia and Egypt and in Babylon. There's a famous sculpture of the Babylonian lion that was supposed to be the king. Lions communicate dominion, unchangeable authority, protection, and it underscores a regal might and victory. A reference to lions often highlights God's power over creation. And we're going to see that in chapter 3. And then, I mean, if you've been in church at all lately, Revelation 5, verses 1 through 5, maybe we ought to read that. Maybe we ought to read Revelation 5, verses 1 through 5. Then I saw, John says this, then I saw in the right hand of him who was seated on the throne a scroll written within and on the back, sealed with seven seals, and I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, "Who is worthy to open the scroll and break its seals?" And no one in heaven or on earth or under earth was able to roll open the scroll or to look into it. And I began to weep loudly because no one was found worthy to open the scroll or to look into it. And one of the elders said to me, "Weep no more, because the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has conquered so that he can open the scroll and its seven seals." We've got the Lion of the tribe of Judah. I mean, isn't this unique? We go from Genesis to Revelation. Beautiful bookends. Beautiful bookends. And when we see this capital L-O-R-D talking about Jehovah, anytime you have Jehovah close, you've got his son, the Lion, that he sends to the world in Bethlehem. I mean, that, I don't know, that just gets to me. But notice it says he roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem. Zion and Jerusalem were often used interchangeably. But this is the platform from which he is to be heard. The place of God's voice of judgment was going to be heard here. He roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem. So let's just keep it in mind that the lion represents kingship, protection, triumph over evil. And then it says, the pastures of the shepherds mourn, and the top of Carmel withers. The pastures of the shepherds. These are the habitations of the shepherds, the ones who are taking care of the sheep. They mourn. You know, the leaders were called shepherds. They were to shepherd the people, the leaders of these kingdoms of Israel, and the leaders of Judah were to be their shepherd. They were to take care of them, to protect them, not take advantage of them like we're going to be seeing. And it's, to me, that just says, you know, we're out here and we're supposed to be your sheep, Uzziah. We're supposed to be your sheep, Jeroboam. You're supposed to be looking out for us, and you're not. And they mourned that. And then it says, and the top of Carmel withers. Carmel is a prominent headland that juts out into the Mediterranean Sea. It is famous for its luxuriant growth of plants in antiquity. And this just harkens back to 1 Kings chapter 18, verses 36 and 37, where Elijah has this confrontation with the prophets of Baal. Remember that? Yep. Where he has that confrontation with them. And it says that the top of Carmel withers. When something withers, it just kind of dries up and, you know, it's not there anymore. Like a lot of my plants, unfortunately for them. Okay. You know, Courtney or Jeff won when we do our training. They always say, "Leave us with some hope." Well, There's the hope. The lion is roaring of the tribe of Judah. There's going to be victory. We're going to have to wait for it. It's not going to show up instantly. But he's coming, and it will.
Thank you.